Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Gentlemen, you're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Tuesday, September 5th, 2023. Hi, Dave.
Hey, hello, Melody, and happy Mute the Microphone Day.
I guess. It's also... Hey, I've been away for 4 days, so what do you expect?
Well, you know, enough said about that. did you know that on this date in 1898, Sarah Edmonds died? Now, you may ask,
yeah, I do. Uh-huh.
Who was Sarah Edmonds?
Uh-huh.
Well,
yes.
In 1861, Miss Edmonds volunteered with an infantry unit in Flint, Michigan for, yes, the Civil War. Disguised as a man under the name of Frank Thompson, she fought in several battles, including the First Battle of Bull Run. She even crossed Confederate lines collecting intelligence disguised as, yes, a woman. Well, perhaps her spying was made possible by Christine Hart, who a decade earlier freed women from the constraints of the god-awful Victorian corset by receiving a patent for the modern brassiere. And the rest, as they say, Melody, is history.
It is, but I like the pizza thing better.
Oh, it is National Cheese Pizza Day, by the way.
Yeah, you know, come on. I said keep things important here, you know, like Donut Day and Pizza Day. Does that include pepperoni?
Nope, not today. It doesn't.
Oh, well.
But, you know. If you're a pizza lover, you know, you got to enjoy it the way you love it.
Yeah, there you go. Why do we love pizza?
Because it's bad for you. And it tastes so yummy.
Nothing like bread, dough, and cheese. All right. Kind of, that's why we love cheese sandwiches, I guess. But, well, let's go ahead and get off the food because I'm going to be getting hungry here soon. Let's get to gold. And this should give you a little bit of an appetite for gold today. If you're in the thinking about buying gold, it's down $12 today. So it's a good time to buy gold. 1927. Silver was down 44 pennies, almost 2%, 2361. Platinum was down 27 at 937. And palladium was down $1, 1250. And that all means the dollar was stronger, and the USDX was up 0.70 at 104.80. Crude oil, depending on where you go, I guess it went above 90. We're looking at some of these aftermarket indicators, so we're looking at crude oil up over $1.86.74. But I'll have to take a peek at my other report and see where we went. The paper markets today had some pressure. The Dow closes nearly 200 points with the rising oil prices. You have the S&P was down 18 and the NASDAQ was down 10. I think European and Asian markets were all negative. Yes, they were. Nikkei was up 100 points, but that's no big deal. 10-year yield is higher today, 4.266, 4.266. And let's take a peek at natural gas is down 6%. Boy, I bet they make a lot of money on that natural gas. 6%, 2.588. So lots of the talk about today, but I think one of the biggest Congress's returns with the clock ticking to avert government shutdown, Dave. Woohoo! Let's shut that government down. Anyway, but I think one of the big news and one of the biggest impacts, again, was the Saudi. The Saudis had announced today that it's extending its 1 million barrel per day voluntary crude oil production cut all the way till the end of the year. Now, this reduction is going to put the Saudi crude output near 9 million barrels a day over October, November, December. And then they're going to review it on a monthly basis. Riyadh first applied the 1 million barrels per day reduction in July, and it has since extended it monthly. The cuts add to 1.66 million barrels per day of other voluntary crude output declines that some of the members of OPEC have put in place. And again, those, what OPEC did, they put those in place until the end of 2024. Fellow heavyweight oil producer Russia also pledged to voluntarily reduce exports by 500,000 barrels per day. That was back in August, and 300,000 barrels this month. You had the deputy prime minister said today that it, too, will extend its 300-barrel-per-day reduction of, until the end of December. So not just this month but or August, but until the end of the year. And they're going to continue to review it on a monthly basis. So these are all voluntary because they are outside of OPEC's plus's official policy. And OPEC's Secretary General has previously said that resorting to voluntary reductions outside of OPEC decisions does not suggest division. No. In policy views among alliance. You'll just find one of them with their heads cut off or something. But anyway.
Yes, kumbaya.
Yeah.
Well, we know the Saudis face a difficult juggling act between these production cuts and the financial blow to its oil-reliant economy. Losses incurred by trimming production as well, and indirectly market volumes could be partially offset by increases in the Saudis' sale prices and in the global oil prices that underpin them. After hanging below $75 a barrel for the better part of the first half of this year, global futures shot up by more than $10 over the summer. More recently, prices have been boosted by security risks in OPEC member Gabon and the threat of disruption in the Gulf of Mexico in the wake of Hurricane Idalia. Now, the Paris-based International Energy Agency expects increasing supply tightness in the second half of this year as demand recovers in China. That's an assumption, not a done deal. But China's the world's largest importer of crude oil. Saudi Arabia depends on these oil revenues to support their so-called giga projects designed to diversify its economy. Now, crude output cuts and a fall in oil prices earlier this year led to a slowdown in the, Saudi Arabia's GDP, which expanded at an annual rate of 1.1% in the second quarter. That's down from 4% in the first and 11% at the same time last year. Saudi state-controlled Aramco typically sells crude supplies through annual contracts that often state minimal volumes to be made available to clients. Now, also at stake is the prospect of conceding market share to Russia and Iran, which produce similar quality oil to the Saudis and primarily directed their exports to China with heavy discounts during their economic downturn.
Well, you know, earlier when I was giving the market report, I was talking about the Treasury yields, how they climbed again today. And by mid-morning, the yield on the 10-year Treasury was already up more than 6 basis points. And the 2-year Treasury yield was last at 4.918, and that climbed by 5 basis points. So, again, it's back to, you know, everyone is investors and are kind of weighing the outlook for the economy and what is this going to mean? What's the Fed going to do? Fridays, we talked about Friday's non-farm payrolls. A report for August showed that the headline unemployment rate did rise to 3.8%. And, of course, this is the highest level since February of 2022. So, and that is a sharp increase from July's 3.5%. But let's not forget the government's U6 rate. Now, this includes discouraged job seekers. That shot up over 7%. And so, really, folks, that's the real unemployment number, Dave.
That's true, Melody. Average hourly earnings also increased by a paltry 0.2% on a monthly basis, and 4.3% compared to a year ago, both of which were lower than expected. Many investors took this as a sign that inflationary pressures, again, could be easing and the Fed's interest rate hikes taking effect, which, of course, has been the Fed's policy goal, you know, alongside slowing down the overall economy with reining in inflation. The latest data come as uncertainty about the Fed's policy path has grown following mixed economic data, which has continued to reflect some resilience. Fed Chair Jerome Powell suggested from Jackson Hole recently that interest rates may still go higher and that the Fed will do what it has to bring it down to 2%. Now, markets are still expecting the Fed to leave rates alone at its next meeting later this month, but views about what could happen at future Fed meetings later this year are split.
Well, you know, speaking of future Fed meetings, you have this guy, Fed Governor Christopher Waller. He said that the recent round of strong economic data will buy the Fed some time as it decides whether additional interest rate hikes are needed to control inflation. You know, it's so ridiculous, Dave. Raising rates really isn't helping inflation. I mean, is it really?
Well, that's the question, isn't it?
It isn't.
I mean, we've talked a lot about this over the past 18-plus months, but, I mean, especially the last 6 months. You know, there's a big debate between those who, you know, think that the Fed is responsible for bringing inflation down. There are others who say that there are other forces at work, and that, you know, the effects of Fed actions, you know, take much longer to have an impact. So who knows? As we occasionally say, it is what it is.
I mean, they're basing in the raising of the interest rates of slowing down the economy. Well, you know, you mess with an economy that really isn't real to begin with, and it's based on debt. So you're playing with the key denominator that's pushing the economy, which is debt, and you start playing with that where it's going to cost more and more. I can't see how anybody could look at anything other than we're heading for a disaster. And raising the rates really isn't stopping inflation. It's, you know, maybe at one point in time it did. But I don't think the things are equal to when we make past comparisons from when we were in the 80s. And they raise rates how high to fight inflation. Things are different. We didn't have any, I don't think then, and we had an economy that was, the economy wasn't based on consumer spending. The economy wasn't based on debt. at that, not to the degree that it is today.
Well, that's a point to think about. I just wonder what these people are on the Federal Open Market Committee are thinking about. You know, are they really data driven? Do they really think that they're the movers and shakers, that they'd have us appear to believe they are? I don't know.
I don't think they're data driven. I think they're market driven. And as long as there's no impacts on them, they'll continue to try to do what they need to try to get us out to from where, because you can't live in an economy where you have zero rate interest. I mean, it doesn't work. That is not a sign of a healthy. I mean, things just don't work. But we've got ourselves into this position, in this place, and you know, it doesn't matter what they do. We're heading down a rat hole.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's go ahead.
I wonder where we'd be right now if, instead of having raised interest rates the way they have, if they had left interest rates alone, or you know, massaged them just a tad, and instead just relied on the selling of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, you know, that they've added to their balance sheet over the last couple of years, and just to see how that alone, I mean, we know, among other things, that money supply is down as a result of their quantitative tightening, and I don't mean the interest rates. I mean, it's this other area. So, you know, I've always been concerned about the Fed overreacting on both ends of the business cycle, you know, on the way up and on the way down. You know, here, I guess we'll never know, right? But boy, I'd sure love to see some other people think about that.
Well, the thing of it is, inflation's not going away. I mean, anybody goes to the grocery store. So if inflation is, their numbers are going down, but they base their happy rate, the 2% target, that might be going down. But that's an artificial number. It's not a real number. It's not what the people in this country are paying. So you got used cars in there that helps with the inflation. Okay, so we had a peak in used cars. We had a peak in housing. Well, we know those aren't sustainable prices. So, yeah, they're going to come down. That'll reflect inflation going down. Look at our gasoline. We don't have any more reserve to go in there to put to drain and or we to drain it to help prices down again. That's gone. So to me, and you know, so the data, it's market. You know, you have the non-farm payrolls report that showed better than expected growth of 187,000 jobs in August. But they're saying that it's coming down a little bit. I don't think that's, you know, I don't know what they were expecting. What were they, 170? Big deal, 170 to 187 is not a big, you know. If they were expecting 100 versus 187, yeah, then I'd say it was, you know, better than expected. But anyway, that's how I view things. But,
well, Atlanta Fed President Rafael Bostic might be more in agreement with you. He says, you know, hey, leave rates alone. We think we've done enough. Or I think we've done enough. Let's wait and see what happens to the overall economy. I mean, come on, we're going to have our first reading of third quarter GDP in another month.
And I hear the music. When we come back, we're going to talk briefly on raising the retirement age. We'll be right back.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home. And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me you're too blind to see. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down, never gonna run around and desert you. Never gonna make you cry, never gonna say goodbye, never gonna tell.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. And visit the website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. As I said, it looks like we know they're going to have to do something to Social Security. I mean, it's just going to happen. And it's just a matter of time because the money ain't there. And so it's kind of, all those people are back in Washington. Their vacations are ending. And, of course, we have the government shut down on October 1st, fingers crossed. Also as part of a last-minute negotiations to rein in spending, a group of Republican lawmakers wants to balance the budget by targeting programs like Social Security. So this was unveiled in June by House conservatives, would raise the full retirement age when seniors are entitled to full benefits. They approved a fiscal blueprint that would gradually increase the normal retirement age to 69 years old for seniors who turn 62 in 2023. I thought it was 70. The current full retirement age is 66 or 67. For all Americans born in 1960 or later, it's 67. I thought it was 70.
There's late retirement. If you don't want your full benefit at age 67, you can wait until you're 70, and your benefit grows, I think, by 8% a year over that period. So it's certainly a marketing strategy. The government wants as many people, as many beneficiaries to wait till then. Because it's an actuarial game. It's a demographic game. The shorter, or the less people live before they're all their things being equal, the shorter people live, the more money's left in the trust fund, and vice versa. The longer they live, more benefits are paid out, the less trust fund money is available. But I didn't see anything about this proposal increasing the late retirement date. It could be. I mean, it should go up with the other ages.
70 to 80?
No, I'd say 7. You know, if they're going from 67 to 69, they go from 70 to 72.
Well, I think there's a lot of other programs they could cut. Better than raising the age. Of course, Americans aren't going to do what the French people did. They went crazy when it went from 55 to 56 or something stupid like that.
62, yeah.
Yeah, they went crazy, but they didn't change it, though. I guess they're still going to do it. But, I think there should be better programs that you can have your own money invest as you're growing old and be responsible for your own retirement. But anyway, I guess there are some programs out there that you can, but there should be more of them somehow to encourage people to save. But then if people saved, we wouldn't have a 70% consumer economy. So anyway, it's just so backwards. This is interesting, too. You know, we have the North Korea and Russia. This is big in the news. Are looking to forge into a deeper military and political relationship because, Russia needs more weaponry. White House official says that North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un plans to travel to Russia to meet Putin this month. And, of course, an arms negotiation between the country is top priority. The New York Times reported that Kim would likely travel. I heard he would travel in an armored train. So I think that's how he's done it before. I mean, this isn't his first trip. Or what was it, China that he went to, that he was in an armored train?
Yep.
Yeah. So plus you have talks between Putin and Turkey President Erdogan aimed at reviving a grain export deal with Ukraine. That ended in failure yesterday with Putin saying that the agreement wouldn't be revived unless obstacles to Russian exports were removed.
Yeah, what caught my eye in some foreign affairs today was this story about the U.S. possibly looking into housing American nuclear weapons in the United Kingdom. According to the Federation of American Scientists, there's a location around 100 kilometers outside of London, which is the planned storage area. Atomic bombs had been stored at the Lakenheath Royal Air Force Base from 1954, before they were removed in 2008. So, of course, that's raising eyebrows among both Russians, but also anti-nuclear activists in the UK. So it'll be interesting to see how this issue progresses.
Well, here's a new index. This is a new household budget index from Primerica, and of course they're a financial service company. They found. Now, this is kind of interesting. The purchasing power of middle-income households. Now, those are defined as people who make $30,000 to $130,000. I don't look at those as middle-income households, Dave, not $30,000, but this was Primerica. That increased slightly to 97.5 in July, up from 97% the month before. Still below the index's baseline of 100% as January of 2019, any reading under the threshold shows consumer spending power is at a deficit. So you can look at this modest uptick. After the credit card debt surpassed $1 trillion for the first time last month, and a string of recent data showing that more consumers are having trouble paying their debts on time. So the CEO thinks that it's important to realize that is that while things are not getting as bad as fast as they were, they're still not necessarily getting good. Inflation has been dragging down. Middle-income households are underwater for over a year. We saw American spending power dip to a low point of 85.2% in June of 2022. And the survey now shows it's down from its high of 102 in November of 2020. So,
yeah, that's though inflation has cooled since it was as high as 9.1% last summer, households haven't come close to fully recovering from that blow. Williams, the CEO, said the index is not yet back to 100. And when you get to 100, it simply means that families have enough earned income in that month to cover their expenses. So in this index, 100 is the break-even point. So if you look at the some of these numbers, I mean, you can see why many Americans, middle income in particular, are struggling. I agree with you, Melody. The 30,000 number seems pretty low.
Poverty level is, it was 27 or something like that. So,
yeah, it's, I mean, now that 30,000 obviously for a single person, but I still think it's way too low. But here, according to Primerica, in the 55-month period, the index covers going back to 2019, middle-income households have been at a spending deficit for 44 of those months, 4 out of 5 months. For 44 months, families have been underwater, Williams says, which means they didn't have enough earned income to cover their expenses. Thus, spending was coming from the withdrawal of the pandemic savings or, more recently, using credit cards. So again, credit card balances hit $1 trillion. When was that? Last month, up almost 5% from last year, according to the New York Fed. And the St. Louis Fed reports outstanding credit balances just surpassing $1 trillion. Both indicators record highs. In a separate study, finds that 51% of credit card borrowers can't pay off their entire balance each month. And that's where you get into a lot of trouble. You get into more trouble if you don't pay your minimum balance. But with the credit card interest now over 20%, and I've seen some that are as high as 30, 31%, if you're in credit card debt, you better find a way to get out of it as soon as you can.
Yeah, it's just amazing. You know, you don't realize how much you just pay that minimum balance on your credit card. And I mean, if you borrow $1,000, it takes 20 years to pay it off.
Oh, it's sad.
It's sad. It really is. But you know what? When I was young, I didn't realize that.
Oh, me neither.
You know?
Me neither.
You just
were interest rates? I mean, when in our formidable early adult years, they were a lot higher even than they are now.
It's difficult once you get into that habit. It's very difficult to break. But we're going to skip on. Let's go down to the small town because we kind of touched on the 2% interest rates.
Yep.
There's a police chief, Josh Smith. You know, and this is happening all over the country, especially in small towns. They're struggling to fill vacancies in their police departments. He warned the town's city council that unless pay and benefits improve, finding new officers, it's not going to happen. And so when nothing changed, he quit. And so did a few of the remaining officers. And this was the Minnesota town of Goodhue, which has about 1,300 residents. And so they shutter its police force in late August. And it turns out America's in the midst, of course we know this, of a police shortage that many in law enforcement blamed on the twofold morale hit of 2020, the pandemic and the things that had happened with George Floyd. Of course, we've seen this happen time and time again from town to town. And now these small towns, the no fund and so forth and everything else, small towns are unable to fill these jobs. It really is sad. And we had, and it, I guess it goes in cycles, Dave. You know, we've seen this happen back in 1972 and 2017, where at least 521 towns and cities with populations of 1,000 to 200,000 disbanded policing, according to a peer-reviewed 2022 newspaper paper. So now we have 12 small towns in the past 2 years that have dissolved their departments.
Yeah, and in some cases, policing is expensive. It's not a matter of not paying enough or providing enough benefits. It's the opposite. It's that the pay and benefits are so costly that some of these communities can't afford it. I know in Pennsylvania, there's been a trend, and a trend of smaller towns primarily. There's one exception I know of, but smaller towns across the state are dropping their own police forces and banding together with one, two, three, sometimes more joining communities to have these regional police forces. It's just more cost effective, I guess. In Pennsylvania, a lot of small towns for decades were served by the Pennsylvania State Police, particularly rural, small rural towns who no way could afford to recruit, you know, just one police officer in many cases. But the Pennsylvania State Police laid down the law a couple of years ago and said, you have until, I forget what the date is, it might have already passed. They said, you have X amount of time to put a plan together because we're no longer going to serve these rural communities unless there's an active local police force there. So it's an interesting dilemma for police forces of all sizes. And, you know, with them operating in a fishbowl like any other public official, but more so police, there's a stigma now in many parts of the country that, you know, make it difficult for one growing up or even in college wanting to become a law enforcement officer. This one guy in this Texas town lamented, as you lose your schools, you lose your businesses, you lose your police force, how much longer can a town actually be viable? It's a good point, Melody, and I don't know how this and where this all ends, but it's clearly a big marketing challenge for cities across the towns, small towns and villages across the country.
Well, I mean, it's a big problem, like you said, in these small towns, but all across the country, the views of the police force have certainly been changing and everything. And it really is. I actually saw something where where they just mob a place and so forth, where they now have gases that will go off and the robbers can't see what they're shoplifting. And I mean, it's crazy, but that's why we have our weapons too. So we'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival. Such a fine sight to see. It's a girl, my lord, in a flatbed Ford, slowing down to take a look at me. Come on, baby. Don't say
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Melody's taking care of other client business. This final segment, you can reach her at 1-800-375-4188. We talked about Social Security earlier, and you know, for decades, runaway Medicare spending is the featured story of the federal budget. Now, turns out that flat Medicare spending might be a bigger one. Something strange has been happening in this massive federal program. Instead of growing and growing as it always has, spending at least per Medicare beneficiary has nearly leveled off. Now, the trend can be a little hard to see because as the baby boomers have aged, the number of people using Medicare has grown. And just on a pure outlay basis, there is more spending. And it's had enormous consequences for the deficit. Budget news often sounds apocalyptic, I admit, but the Medicare trend has been unexpectedly good for federal spending, saving taxpayers a huge amount, at least relative to projections. David Cutler, who's a professor of health policy and medicine at Harvard, who helped the Obama White House develop the infamous Affordable Care Act, said, without a doubt, this is the most important thing that has happened to the federal budget in the last 20 years. Now, the reason for the per person slowdown is a bit of a mystery. Scholars have been arguing about it for years, but no one seems sure enough to confidently predict whether it's likely to stick around for much longer. Some of the reductions are easy to explain. Congress has changed Medicare policy over the recent past. The biggest shift came with the Affordable Care Act in 2010, which reduced Medicare's payments to hospitals and to health insurers that offered private Medicare Advantage plans. Congress also cut Medicare payments as part of a budget deal the following year in 2011, but most of the savings can't be attributed to any obviously policy shift. In a recent letter to the Senate Budget Committee, economists at the Congressional Budget Office described the huge reduction in its Medicare forecast between 2010 and 20. Most of those reductions came from a category the CBO calls technical adjustments, which it uses to describe changes to public health and the practice of medicine itself. Older Americans appear to be having fewer heart attacks and strokes. It's a likely result of effective cholesterol and blood pressure meds that became cheap and widely used, and drug makers and surgeons haven't developed as many new blockbuster treatments recently, so there's no new Prozac or angioplasty to drive up spending. Plus, Medicare is currently barred from law from covering the new class of expensive and popular anti-obesity drugs. Well, parts of the health system appear to have become more efficient, too, as medical providers have been more cautious about adopting new therapies that don't have much evidence behind them, and more care is shifted outside hospitals into cheaper settings. Melinda Button, formerly of CBO and who now studies Medicare at Johns Hopkins, says the direction of recent federal policies and choices by private insurers have caused doctors, nurses, and hospital administrators to become more cost conscious. That budgetary good news isn't all good news for people with Medicare. I mean, reductions in heart attacks have and strokes have big benefits for public health, but the scarcity of major medical breakthroughs has been accompanied by slowing improvements in life expectancy for seniors. And the cost containment strategies in hospitals mean patients have been denied the treatments of their choice, or they're getting sent home a lot quicker than they had in the past. Medicare may even wind up saving money because of COVID, of all things, because the older Americans who died from the disease tended to have other illnesses that would have been expensive to treat if they had survived. And if Medicare spending had grown the way it had for much of its history, federal spending would have been almost $4 trillion higher since 2011, and deficits would have been more than a quarter larger. That's according to an analysis by the group Upshot. The difference is more than that could have been saved by raising the eligibility age for Social Security or converting Medicaid into a block grant. Controversial proposals that have been offered by some, particularly Republican legislators, concerned about the federal debt. It's so much money that almost no major legislation passed during this period comes close in scale. And even some major deficit reduction proposals, like the one known as Simpson-Bowles, aren't much bigger. The Trump tax cuts cost an estimated $2 trillion over 10 years. The recent deficit reduction deal passed by Congress in the IRA will save a relatively modest $1 trillion in comparison. And a new Medicare policy that will allow it to negotiate the prices of some prescription drugs, 10 to start, is expected to save just under $100 billion over a decade. Josh Gordon at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, that's a nonpartisan group that supports deficit reduction, said there's basically no recent hints of history of the kind of actual budgetary savings similar to what we've seen with the Medicare spending slowdown. Now, those savings have affected Congress's appetite for other budgetary choices. Medicare itself might look very different if it had been consistently busting the budget. In 2011, near the beginning of this trend, congressional Republicans were talking seriously about changing the very structure of Medicare by converting it into a private voucher program to, well, hold back its future cost. In fact, Senator Mitt Romney's presidential platform in 2012 featured such a plan. But proposals of that sort have fallen out of favor in recent years. The fact that spending has remained so much lower than expected has allowed us to put these decisions off for a while. That's Sherry Glide, the dean of the Wagner School of Public Service at NYU. But Medicare spending is unlikely to disappear as a concern for the budget and for its policymakers, members of Congress. An aging population means the number of Americans relying on the program is still growing rapidly. And analysts continue to worry that the trend's an aberration and that some new development, like an effective Alzheimer's drug, a cultural turn away from cost cutting, the health burden of long COVID, or some other chronic condition, will return Medicare spending to form. CBO, which has lowered its forecast repeatedly during the period in the face of lower spending, continues to expect growth to tick up again, and soon. Right now, Medicare is growing more slowly than ever, but still more quickly than the rest of the federal budget. If the slowdown per beneficiary ends, it will strain the Medicare trust fund and drive up the federal debt, and may end up dominating the Washington policy conversation once again. That means the uncertainty about the future has high stakes. Button said, I used to call this the trillion-dollar question. Now it's more than a trillion. Yes, to paraphrase the late Everett Dirksen, ladies and gentlemen, a trillion here, a trillion there, and soon you're talking about real money. Now, walk in any direction in Las Vegas these days, and it's easy to find machines doing human work. Check-in kiosks have replaced people at the front desks of hotels. Text bots now make restaurant recommendations instead of a live concierge. Robots can serve food, and behind the bar, machines are pouring out drinks. That is, they're pouring drinks for customers. Automation and technology replacing jobs has long been a conversation. In this case, in Nevada's most populated city. Listen to this. Studies show that between 38 to 65% of jobs in Las Vegas could be automated by 2035. That's a lot. With the use of artificial intelligence on the rise, the economy of this city, which relies on tourism and hospitality, is at a crossroads as companies look to technology to reduce their labor costs. Wherever the resort industry can replace their workers and not affect productivity, profits, or the customer experience, wherever they can do that with artificial intelligence, they will. Those are the chilling words of John Restrepo, principal at RCG Economics in Las Vegas. The question is, he added, how do you factor in and how do you adapt your economic development strategy, your community strategy, your resilience strategy to accommodate a world where certain jobs no longer exist? Restrepo said he believes the city has to diversify its economy to be less reliant on tourism and hospitality. He believes we need to move to those occupations that are more highly skilled, that are not easily replaced by AI, and that provide a greater level of balance and resilience so that we're not so hard hit. Certainly easier said than done. Unions in Las Vegas are closely watching the changes. The largest union in Nevada, the Culinary Union, represents 60,000 service and hospitality workers in Vegas and Reno. Later this year, it hopes to have a new negotiated contract that includes protections against AI replacing jobs. Sound familiar? Like the actor and writer strikes in Hollywood? Ted Papageorge, the secretary treasurer of the union, said, we had a huge fight about tech in our previous contract. We're going to have the same fight this time around. In the last contract in 2018, the union pushed for companies to agree to a six-month warning for workers for new technology introduced in the workplace, as well as free training on how to use the new technology. Papageorge asked, how do our folks make sure that the jobs that do remain, that we can work them, and that we're not thrown out like an old shoe? We're not going to stand for that. Well, while the precise impact of AI on service work isn't yet clear, the union's prepared to make AI an issue to strike over when it negotiates its new contract. That's Papageorge who says that, adding, we'd like to say we're going to be able to get an agreement, but if we have to, we're going to have a big fight and do whatever it takes, including a strike on technology. AI and machines can't replace the human touch anyway, many workers say. Sabrina Bergman works at the Tipsy Robot, the bar inside Planet Hollywood on the Vegas Strip. Her job is to help their robot do its job tending bar. When the robot accidentally tips over a cup, she resets it. And if the robot doesn't pour a full drink, she tops it off. Bergman said she's not worried about the machine replacing her entirely, even though the bar just opened a second location earlier this year. Bergman and other service workers say there are some human jobs that technology just can't eliminate. They said machines don't have the same human touch and can't provide the same experience. And oftentimes the machines add more work. Holly Lang, who's a cocktail waitress at the MGM Grand, said, there's some things you can't replace. We have a lot of guests that are regular guests, and they come for the personal interaction. Artificial intelligence won't just impact lower-wage service jobs. Technology like ChatGPT, which is a form of generative AI, will impact white-collar jobs, too, in fields like accounting and data entry. In some cases, experts say AI will help make workers more productive, while other roles will be eliminated entirely. But AI, they say, is also likely to create brand new jobs that don't even exist yet. There's one Vegas business owner said he wants to learn how to use AI to build his company and use the technology to help him with tasks like dealing with customer evaluations. He said it's the next frontier. It's just like people didn't believe in the internet in the 1990s. This is the next revolution, and if you're not on board, you're going to be left behind, and I don't want to be left behind. We'll talk about damned if you do and damned if you don't. We're off and running, and where it leads, nobody yet knows. Hey, our American Survival newsletter is on a Labor Day hiatus this week. It'll return next Monday, featuring Doug Nolan's weekly credit bubble bulletin blog, Apothecary Herb's Wendy Wilson's Food for Thought, my insights column, and of course, Melody's weekly market recap. And that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back on Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. Thanks, as always, to our production guru, Todd Waite, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Stay cool. Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In